The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Oh, hey, Chuck.
Hey, Chris.
So we're back.
Absolutely.
Now, one thing that I heard about you is that you run a very efficient clinic and a very efficient practice.
I sure like to think so.
So let's go through some of the keys. I think we've distilled this into 7 points.
Great.
What do you think are some highlights about how you like to approach your practice?
Yeah, I do think my practice efficiency is something that is helpful to discuss with the fellows. I think all of us have practice efficiencies. And I think the fellows and residents get a little bit out of that. Ultimately, I don't think it matters until you yourself are in practice. You have to figure it out for yourself because we're all different. But there are a few things that I do that I really like, and I'll share some of them, and I want you to share some as well. So the first thing I do, which I think is probably the single most valuable thing I do, and some of those listeners may roll their eyes, on the way home after surgery, I call every single patient I operated on. And I try to make it easy. I have an email with phone number, so I just click when I'm driving home. And certainly the early patients of the day, I just do when I'm driving home. And I check in, and I have a standard shtick, and it takes usually 30 seconds. Some patients and families are super grateful. Some must think that every doctor calls after every surgery. But I do it for a couple of reasons. One's to reestablish the rapport. Two, to let patients know that I really do care. Three, I can head off problems, and I really think that matters. For me, it's been a really important part of my practice.
So how do you deal with the logistics of that? Are you calling from your personal cell phone?
Yeah, so I call from my personal cell phone, and knock on wood, I've never regretted it. Patients do not knowingly, and I'll explain what I mean by that, take advantage of it. Occasionally, I'll get the phone call thinking they're calling the office or something, but patients don't abuse it.
So do you screen your calls, any incoming call you don't know, you don't answer? Or?
Nah.
You just answer it?
I just answer it. And I maybe I've gotten lucky, but I've been doing this for a lot of years and not really been a problem.
So I did your rotation as a fellow towards the end of my fellowship. And for 2 years in practice, I did exactly the same thing that you did. But I called them the day afterwards. And it was so painful. It was so painful. While most patients were totally fine, and honestly, it was a very reasonable thing to do in terms of, you know, the experience itself. It was nice. You know, the patients appreciated it. To me, it just took so long because I couldn't get a hold of a lot of patients. So what do you do if you can't get a hold of me? Do you message? Like,
yeah. So a couple things. Number one, the next day is the wrong choice. Maybe have your nurse call if you're going to call the next day, but the next day is different. If you put a block in, the block's worn off. Patients have been sitting around for a while, or they may not be at home. Either case is not ideal. So if you call them the night of surgery, they're home almost always. The block's still working, or the local that you put in is still working. And so there's not a lot to talk about, which is part of the point.
I wish I had known that.
Yeah, so I really do like it, and I really would recommend it. And again, it's not for everybody. I'd like to think it cuts down on later phone calls. We've talked about actually doing a study, but we're never going to do that study. But anyways, that's number one for me.
Do you still call primary carers or referring doctors?
I do not do that. Do you?
I try for the nerve stuff.
For the bigger stuff.
Yeah, for the bigger stuff, for, you know, stuff that I'm trying to build a practice, and I do. But for the more routine, and I won't call for that.
Yeah, good one. All right. Tell us one of yours.
So I like to consolidate the pain. I like to put all of my very involved patients as much as I can into one clinic.
And is that all your nerve patients?
So a lot of them. You know, clearly there are, I love nerve patients. You know, don't to anybody listening, don't get the wrong impression. But it is a more involved visit. And as, you know, we've noted before, we are overscheduled. A lot of patients have 10-minute slots or shorter, and we're double or triple booked in those slots. So trying to give those patients the amount of time that they need and honestly truly deserve is very difficult in when you're seeing those patients in your normal, you know, hand surgery clinic workflow. So establishing a complex nerve clinic has been incredibly beneficial to take the step back, not feel rushed, give the patients the time that they need. And, you know, while it is a tough thing to see 20 nerve patients in a day in a nerve clinic, it makes a world of difference. And my mind state's different in that clinic because I'm not trying to get through a number of patients, and knowing I'm not thinking of the patients that are waiting because I'm spending extra time in this room. I feel better about it. I feel it's better for the patients too.
I think that's a great point. And I would add that I do that some of the time. So my complex congenital kids are typically seen on the same day. But there are other clinics I have where patients travel a really long distance, and typically with congenital, but sometimes with sports stuff. And I have to take time with them, right? They can't travel 6 hours or take a plane and then me running it out in the typical 5 minutes. I have to spend time with them. And then I'm playing catch up. So I agree with you. To best of our abilities, that is a great plan, and that's the way it should be done. Totally agree.
So how do you set up your day for success in the OR?
Yeah, the other thing I do, which, again, it takes time, but for me, the investment in time is worth it. And so I run two rooms almost always, and I think I can do that safely and efficiently. I can treat more patients without cutting any corners. But I do that through preparation. And so I design my two-room schedule 2 days before. After the lineup set, I will arrange the cases myself. So, for example, if I start at 7:30, the first case goes from 7:30 to 8. Second case may technically start a little before 8 and then go till 8:15. And I do that all day. So that's lined out. The lineup is outlined in an email and carefully thought out based on the case, based on who my assistants are. In that same email, I add in, you know, what equipment I need to make sure that's there. And then I share that with the operating room, with my nurse, et cetera. And I think it's incredible. It also gets me thinking the 2 days in advance about the surgeries and makes me prepare at that juncture, even before we do an indications conference typically. So I've already started thinking about the cases. So it just gets the process going, gets me in the right frame of mind and make sure I'm set up to succeed.
Now, do you think when you're trying to set the lineup, do you put the cases that you think are going to be more mentally intense and physically intense for you at the beginning of the day or at the end of the day? Because I've found that some surgeons approach that differently.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's very personal choice. I typically put my smaller cases, so carpals, triggers, ganglions, simple fractures, in the morning. I do that for a couple of reasons. One, I just like to get the day going. It feels good to get a number of cases done. Number two, I think from the same perspective, the operating room runs more smoothly in the morning. And as you start getting on the day, it's just harder and people go to lunch. And so I think when you get the bigger cases and you can put the bigger cases around lunch, it helps with nurses getting their time. But you're right. If you have a bunch of bigger cases, sometimes that can get tiresome at the end of the day. And you have to make sure you have the energy to do that until your last case is done.
It's those medium-sized cases with a little bit of uncertainty in terms of how long they're going to take that really can kill your schedule.
Absolutely.
And at the beginning of my practice, I was more like you in terms of getting the wins in the beginning of the day and getting your day going and knocking out a number of cases. But I've realized, I think in my experience, I'd rather have those medium kind of cases at the beginning of the day and get them done, because I know that although there is more uncertainty in terms of the length of the case, the team is fresher at the beginning of the day. So things probably are going to move a little bit better for that case where you don't know what trays you're going to need and what implants you're going to use, and there's a lot of possibles. While when it goes well, it's fantastic. When it doesn't go well, it throws your whole day for a loop.
Right. It absolutely can. The other interesting thing about our local only cases, and I'm not sure how it works for you. We do our surgeries in two different operating, our primary surgeries in two different operating rooms. For me, the anesthesia team has requested that I do my local only, no IV, no anesthesia involvement at the end of the day, which I actually don't mind. So it's the smaller stuff. So I'll do smaller cases to start with anesthesia involved, bigger cases. And then at the end of the day, I usually have one, two or three little bitty cases. Patients can eat or drink all day, so they're not put off. They go to work. They drive themselves to the surgery center, and then they get there an hour early instead of a longer pre-arrival time. And it's a nice way to end the day. It's the same kind of feeling at the end of the day. So that doesn't bother me, even though it's a little bit different philosophy.
And it's a lot easier to do, you know, your carpals, triggers on our local at the end of the day when you've had, even if you've been kind of roughed up by a case earlier. It's easier to get into a more routine mind state. Whereas if I've got a big case hanging over me at the end of the day, that doesn't feel great from an energy perspective.
Yeah. And I certainly set up my life where I try to do predictable cases on a two-room day when I'm really busy. And if I have a case that may be more, even if it could be outpatient, I might try to do it on a different day if that's possible.
Yeah.
What's next for you?
So as a young faculty member, I'm very interested in building my practice and getting an efficient practice going. And I remember one thing that our former vice chair and now current chair at Vanderbilt Orthopedics, Rick Wright, said when we were doing orientation kind of stuff. And he said, you should always feel a little bit uncomfortable and a little bit behind in clinic, because if you're not, you're not seeing enough patients. Now, you know, for those of you that are listening that are outside of the United States system, perhaps the volume pressures are a little bit different. And for me, the volume pressure is merely a more self-imposed thing. I want to see more patients. I want to take care of more patients, and I want to do more more surgeries down the line because I want to get better at what I do, and I love what I do. But I do like the thrill of an efficient clinic. Now, nobody's high-fiving you at the end of an efficient clinic because they think that's how it's supposed to go. But when you have a great clinic and you have seen just the right amount of patients you want to see, and you've done all your dictations, and you're still out of the door at the time that you want to be out the door, that feels really good. Now, the flip side of that is that you can't keep people waiting too long, because once people are waiting too long, then it just becomes, you walk into the room apologizing. So clinic, to me, is a lot of ways more stressful than the OR, because we're trying to meet these demands, either intrinsic or extrinsically imposed, of seeing a lot of patients, while the patients, I don't think, quite understand that.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is a tricky thing. It is highly unpredictable, because one 60-patient clinic may be smooth and you walk out of there thinking, I am really good at this, and you have a same number of patients the next week and it goes to hell.
Yeah.
And you don't really know what went wrong. It can be one patient that takes your time. And I really try to never leave the clinic room before every patient's satisfied. I can't say I'm 100% successful with that, but it's highly unpredictable. The OR is way more predictable.
So speaking of the OR, what's the next thing that, pearl that you can give, some experience with?
Yeah, one thing I really like is the opportunity to work with my partners. During residency, you get a chance to work with other residents, rarely residents of your same year for most programs, but you get a chance to work with others in training. And then when you get into practice, it's a situation where you can be immediately working almost in a silo, where you go to clinic with yourself. Maybe you have a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant with you. Maybe you have a trainee with you, but you rarely get a chance, in my experience, to work with your partners. And there is joy in that, and there is satisfaction in that. And I'm in a situation now where I work with Lindley Wall every week at the Shriners Hospital. Is great. I occasionally work with other partners, but it's just stimulating. It's just, you never think about things exactly the same. You can learn from each other. Lindley and I happen to do indications conference together every week. I think it's great. I know you have the same experience.
Yeah, working with Dave Brogan and Marty Boyer has been fantastic, because, again, it's different ways of thinking about it. From a logistical perspective, it makes the case just feel so much better. Some of the decision-making processes and then some of the actual dissection parts are just moved along and made much more enjoyable by having somebody else in the room. And I think that is something that if we could take more advantage of, I would. And I would encourage anybody who's setting up a practice to avail yourselves to your partners and do as much as you can.
At least intermittently. It's not the most efficient, whether that be just life or whether that be billing, but it is enjoyable. And that's got to be part of this algorithm.
Yeah.
What's next for you?
So in clinic, unfortunately, our sending patients to x-ray can take a long time. So I try to minimize the amount of time I send patients to x-ray and hand surgery. We're very fortunate that we have, a mini fluoroscopy machine, which minimizes radiation, but also is incredibly efficient in terms of walking patients over, getting the exam done yourself, counseling the patient in real time, and not having to send somebody over, have them wait and sometimes register for, the x-ray, get the x-ray done, and then come back and get back in your room. It moves the patient visit along. It keeps your clinic rooms flowing. And then there are a lot of other things that you can do to improve your clinic efficiencies. Standardizing your injection process. I have a whiteboard that is outside of the clinic space where, if I'm walking out of a room and my assistant is in a different room, I can just leave a note saying, this is what I want. And sometimes there are hours we go by without actually talking to each other, which for better or worse. But I think there are a lot of ways to move things along in a manner that makes things flow efficiently.
Yeah, and turning towards your medical assistant or your nurse, and you know, sometimes if you have the right person on your team, they can help you see how you can be efficient, because we all have blind spots. And certainly x-ray is an obvious one, but there's probably a million of them in kind of that continuous improvement process. It's, again, a little corny, but it is a process that we should all think about.
We're really corny on this podcast. We keep excusing ourselves for being corny.
My daughters would call me a dork, but you know.
I'm a nerd. I know that's how I describe. So what's your next pearl of advice? The final Chuck Goldfarb's ultimate advice.
Yeah, I don't. This may not be actually as practical or as some of what we've said, because I think there's some really good stuff. But I would just say, in your practice, stay broad as long as you can. And what I mean by that is stay broad as far as age of patients you treat, diagnoses you treat. Don't limit yourself early, even if you step into a practice that kind of wants you to, because when you narrow yourself, it's really hard to expand back out later. And I have, over time, narrowed myself. I see younger patients predominantly. Sports and congenital dominate my practice. A weird combination, but they dominate my practice. I still see some bread and butter. But that's something that's going to be hard to go another direction. So if I ever move practices, which I have no intention of doing, but then starting broad again will be tricky.
Yeah, no, I've talked about this with some other people kind of around my stage and career, and some people take a very different approach. They'll say, all right, well, all I want to do is, you know, young person's ACL injuries, and that's all they'll see from the get-go, and things are slow at the beginning, and then eventually their practice fills with exactly what they want to see. So if that's the practice you want to have, surely you might be limited with what you can do if you ever do move institutions, but that brings them joy.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I remember when I was a trainee, there was a sports surgeon here who basically set a hard age limit of 50 and wanted to see this and didn't want to see that. And there was some criticism from his sports partners and from other members of the department, but he stuck to his guns. And you're right, he was able to build that practice. And had he started broad and then tried to narrow, it might not have worked out the same way. So that's a fair counterpoint.
Yeah, I try to stay broad, although I think that if I really just only wanted to see mainly nerve pathology, I could. My volume would suffer in a sense, and I don't think I'd be as happy with that initially. And I perhaps in the future I'll limit myself a bit more, but I try to stay as broad as I can. I try to do, you know, as much. I draw the line on some things where I know that other people are better at it than I am. I don't like a lot of complex elbow trauma. I just don't do enough of it, and I don't want those issues in my practice. You know, I probably should be doing more small joint arthroplasty, but we're blessed by having somebody, Marty Boyer, who does a ton of it and does it well.
And wants to do it.
Yeah, and wants to do it. So I'll send that to him. And, you know, conversely, you know, I love to do nerve stuff, and my partners, you included and others, have been gracious enough to send me those tougher nerve cases, which sadistically I really like.
And that's a blessing. If you have partners where you can have that back and forth and you're all comfortable with that back and forth and not trying to keep every case, because we work in a relatively eat what you kill model, even though we're academics, but that's the right way to do it. You want people who really, you want to be in a group that wants to help one another. And if people have niches that are different from one another, that's just fantastic.
So how much of this do you think applies to people that are outside of our type of practice model?
I think most of it does. I think these are practical pearls.
So then run it down for us again.
All right. So number one, and this again, these are all very subjective and not all of you will choose to do them, but I think they're worth the investment in time. So number one, call your patients after surgery. They will love you for it.
They do love you, and it is incredibly painful if you call them the day afterwards.
So don't do that.
Call them the day of.
For me, I like to realize the potential inefficiencies in my practice, you know, in terms of time, and consolidate those. So that's, for me, having a nerve clinic.
Think about your surgeries a couple days in advance. Set your own lineup. Make sure that you have asked for everything you will need for that case yourself, so own it.
So the fourth one is, I think, feeling a little uncomfortable in terms of, you know, feeling a little pressure, a little internal clock to keep things moving in clinic while balancing, you know, the number of patients you're seeing.
Number five, if you have the opportunity and if you like your partners, work with them when you can. If you don't like your partners, well, that's a whole other story.
Is that why we don't do any cases together?
Chris and I never work together. We suffer through podcasts together. That's it.
So then the sixth point is to find the inefficiencies in your practice, such as sending patients to x-ray and trying to figure out ways around it.
And lastly, stay broad in your practice as long as you can, unless you think you're in a situation where you can really develop a very specialized practice and that'll give you joy. But I think for most of us, stay broad as long as you can.
I hope that was enjoyable and educational for those that were listening.
It was for me. As always, I learned something from Dr. D.
Same here.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.